Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd.
Based on the size of the pelvis and the uniformly coarse granularity of this auricular surface, the victim was a female in her early 30s.
That tiny bit of forensic razzle-dazzle was performed by an actress. Her name is Emily Deschanel on the Fox TV series Bones. She's playing a character named Temperance Brennan, a forensic anthropologist who pretty much always gets to the heart of the week's mystery. But while Deschanel's human avatar may do her science looking impossibly glamorous, the woman who created her, real-life forensic anthropologist and writer Kathy Reichs, has made it her mission to ensure that everything her character does is scientifically possible. Thanks to Reichs' prolific creative output, fans of Temperance Brennan can follow their heroine's adventures on TV and also in a series of best-selling novels, the latest of which is called Speaking in Bones. All of those fictional works are inspired by Reichs' real-life career as a professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and consultant to law enforcement agencies needing to identify who has died and how. The latest of Kathy Reichs' books is called Speaking in Bones. She's in town to speak tonight at 7 at the North Richland Hills Public Library. Kathy, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
In real life, there are some cases you really care about, throw your heart into, that never get solved. In fiction, you're in complete control.
That's correct. And I think that's one of the big fallacies that TV and also books perpetrate on the public is that everything gets solved. And that's not true.
Was that part of the motivation for you in writing, that this was a world in which you were omniscient?
No. Why did I start writing? I made full professor at the university so I could do something new, and I'd written textbooks and journal articles, and nobody'd heard of forensic anthropology back then, and I thought it would be a way maybe to bring my science to a broader audience.
For people who think they know what you do but don't know exactly what the term means, what is forensic anthropology?
Well, bones is a good way to sum it up. Mm-hmm. We're specialists in the human skeleton. We work for law enforcement, the military, various agencies, and private individuals sometimes to do one of two things. One would be identification, figuring out who an unidentifiable body is, if it's burned, mutilated, mummified, dismembered, decomposed, skeletal, for example. And the other would be addressing questions of trauma. What happened to that person? What was the manner of death? Was it gunshot? Was it sharp instrument? Was it blunt instrument, et cetera?
Some crime drama and mystery, not to mention real life stories, can be really brutal. Have you come to an understanding of what makes the genre so irresistible to audiences?
No. murder mysteries have had appeal for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
The only difference today in the type of thing I write is that the solutions to the murders are driven by science rather than intuitive thinking or police legwork, that kind of thing. I think murder is the ultimate evil that you can do. You take away someone's life, and I think people are fascinated with that, why people do it, and then how do you right the wrong that's been done. I think murder mysteries are kind of like a puzzle for readers. Can I figure this out before the author tells me the ending? Who did it? So I think they enjoy it for that reason. And I think it's the author's job to keep the reader guessing and to be clever enough with red herrings and plot twists, as long as you explain everything and it makes sense and you're not relying on coincidence, to surprise the reader at the end. And I know when I read a murder mystery or a thriller, if I do figure it out before the end, I'm disappointed
right.
in the author. I'm proud of myself, of course, but I'm disappointed in the author.
One thing, and I promise to give nothing away here, but in this book and in other books as well, you allow us to go along with Temperance when sometimes she goes down a path that will end up having to be reversed or changed. She's open to new possibilities, but you allow us to sort of follow along in the process. Sometimes really smart scientists are going to make incorrect guesses at first before they conclude what has actually happened.
And that's science, hypothesis yeah. formation, and you keep your hypothesis as long as the data supports it, and if not, you modify it. And that's pretty much the process that temperance follows.
There are some complicated terms in here, and you explain them to us without making it really obvious that you're explaining them to us. But I wonder if part of your motivation here is stealthily motivating people to consider scientific careers.
And particularly stealthily motivating young women, girls, to go into the sciences. Yeah, that's part of it. I think the key to writing science into fiction, people don't want to read a textbook on forensic anthropology or forensic odontology or whatever science I happen to use, but they want to learn something. So the key is to keep it brief, those passages dealing with the science, and to keep it interesting and entertaining, and to keep it jargon-free. It's the same skills I use in addressing a jury. You don't dumb it down, but you want to keep their attention and you want to keep it understandable for them.
Do juries these days sort of sit back in their chairs with the attitude of like, I've seen Bones, I've seen CSI, I've seen Dexter, I understand how this sort of thing works?
Yeah. Yeah, and I know that every case has DNA involved in it, and every case gets solved. And so why isn't there any DNA, even though it's a fender bender, you know? So we call that the CSI effect. Mm-hmm. And I do know some attorneys that take that into account and will explain, maybe in their opening argument, that there will be no DNA evidence for this reason.
Have we placed more faith in DNA than maybe we should? Like, as you said, in some cases it exists and it's helpful, and in other cases it might. Can it be misleading?
I don't think so. I think DNA is a very, very powerful tool if it is used properly, if the laboratory standards are up to protocol and the individuals doing the DNA testing and collecting are competent and reputable. It's not the science that's at fault. It's an incredibly precise science. It's the most precise of the forensic sciences, but it has to be done properly.
You've worked on both sides of the border in Canada and also in the U.S. I wonder how similar the processes are there, if the equipment is comparable, what differences you see in the way crime and crime solving are approached.
Well, yeah, the equipment is all the same. If you have a well-equipped lab, you know, it's not a small rural lab or medical examiner or coroner office that I work at. It's a full spectrum crime and medical legal lab. So that's similar to our higher end labs in this country. I think the big difference is, and I constantly have to explain this to Canadians, they'll say, how is it different from here versus the United States? And I have to explain, there are 50 different states. We have 50 different legal systems. You know, yeah. There's municipal law, and then there's state law, and then there's federal law, et cetera. In Canada, there's one uniform code of criminal law across the whole country. So that's different here in the U.S.
I want to talk about gallows humor. How does this inform your approach to your work as a forensic anthropologist, and how does this inform the way that you formed the character of Temperance Brennan?
Yeah, there is gallows humor, with some exceptions, and that's a tension releaser. You know, if you're in the autopsy room or standing around at an exhumation or digging up, you know, a body from a clandestine grave, it breaks the tension. It's a way to release, you know, anxiety or whatever. In certain cases, there's no gallows humor. Mm-hmm. Kids, dead kids. It'll be absolutely stone silent in the autopsy room. I do use humor in the books. It's a tightrope. It's a real balancing act because the books and the show, we put humor in the show. They actually coined a term for us. They called us a crimity. Because every week you're looking at violent death, and how do you put humor in there and do it without being offensive? And I think that's the same balancing act I have to keep in mind in the books. But I do put humor in the books and in the show as well.
Do you feel like there's, in some ways, crime drama or crime novels or mystery novels, they're morality plays in the sense that we've really liked this kind of literature, as you say, for hundreds of years. We've liked knowing that in the end the bad guy gets caught and the victims—
Or girl.
And the victims are somehow,
avenged. Order is restored and chaos is reassembled and justice is served and good wins out over evil. And, I think that's part of the appeal of it.
So you've got your recurring characters, and then you have the people who sort of come and go based on what the situation is. And I wonder what your process is for developing these individuals. You have maybe the, I don't know if you start with the crime itself and then work back and decide who did it.
I start, it's hard to, it's like soup. Mm-hmm. I have all these particles of ideas floating around in my brain. I want to use this setting. Am I going to put it in North Carolina in the mountains or down in the low country? And then I usually have a case in mind that I've worked on. And I take core elements of a case, just that little nugget of an idea. And then I ask myself, well, what if, you know, what if there was a dismembered body and it had a unique pattern of saw mark analysis in the dismemberment that gave some clue as to the perpetrator? And then I spin it off into fiction from there. And I always change all of the names and the dates and the places for both legal and ethical reasons.
I know that you're really careful for those ethical reasons about changing things. I wonder if you've ever been working a case and had it occur to you this would really work well to be transformed into a work of fiction and then sort of stopped and felt guilty, or if you thought this is just real life and this is the way my brain is working, how do you sort of cope with that?
Well, and it's not just cases. Sometimes I see headlines or mm-hmm. stories that are going on, real events that are taking place, and I think, wow, I just read one today. I can tell you what it is. And I think, wow, there's the good basis for a storyline. But then that's all you start with is that core idea, and then you spin everything else off into fiction.
What was the headline you saw today, if we're not spoiling something two novels down the line?
Holistic doctors, four of them have died, and five more have gone missing over the last 2 months or something.
Wow.
Wow, yeah, what could be causing that? So, yeah, that often happens. I'll see something like that.
Do you have notebooks or computer files, or how do you store all this?
I do. I have a hard copy file called Future Stories, mm-hmm. which I've never gone into to use any of them, but I still stuff things in there. And then I have one on the computer as well, Future Stories. If I come across something, I don't know, on Twitter or something, I'll go, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting.
Do you have a stable of folks that you call that if you have a technical question about, say, police work, that can fill in the details for you?
Yeah, I have some law enforcement people who are very helpful to me. And then I work, as I said, in a full spectrum crime and medical legal lab. Yeah. So I have my colleagues if I need help on entomology, or I need help on, you know, whatever, blood spatter pattern analysis or mitochondrial DNA. I just phone one of them or I walk down the hall and say, gee, I have some questions. And they're always willing to help.
It's funny that you said the word spectrum, because there is a broad spectrum of accuracy. And I'm not an expert, but I've seen shows that I, as you know, just a journalist can tell are complete nonsense. And there's not a lot of reality put in them. And things happen almost magically. You're a real stickler for making sure that the science is right and that nothing happens that couldn't happen in real life.
It has to be at least plausible. Mm-hmm. There has to be any terminology you see, any technology that you see on our show actually exists. We buy all of that stuff on the sets for the Jeffersonian through medical supply houses. So it's real. It's the real deal. Do we push it to the limits? Of course we do. It's television and you have to solve the crime, you know, in whatever our airtime is, 52, it's less than that now, 52 minutes or whatever. But we're not going to get DNA results in 24 minutes or something like that. We do draw the line at that.
We're speaking this hour with Kathy Reichs. She's a forensic anthropologist and professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She's also a novelist. Her newest book is called Speaking in Bones. She's in town to speak tonight at 7 at the North Richland Hills Public Library. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with forensic anthropologist and novelist Kathy Reichs. Her newest book is called Speaking in Bones. She's down to speak tonight at 7 at the North Richland Hills Public Library. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. This book contains a character who is part of this growing movement of amateur sleuths, and we've actually discussed it on this show before. Law enforcement authorities are not quite sure what to do with these folks. They can be helpful and they can be a real impediment to ongoing investigations.
I think they're good with it as long as the web sleuths stay online, which is where they're supposed to stay, on the internet. And they'll visit sites like Namus that list unidentified bodies and sites that list missing persons, for example. They do other things. And then try to match them up and get these nameless dead identified. Okay, fair enough. Who could that be hurting? But when they go offline, as happens in our story, and start maybe potentially mucking up a crime scene or mucking up evidence, I think that's where law enforcement is less than happy with them.
So tell us about this character of Hazel Strike, who goes by Lucky Strike, or is known as Lucky
right.
Strike. She's an interesting figure in the book.
She's a crusty old girl. She shows up at Tempe's lab, and she's been web sleuthing. She's been looking up unidentified dead and missing persons. She shows up at Tempe's lab, and she's got a very, very disturbing audio tape. And on this audio tape is what seems to be a young girl who's terrified and being brutalized by two men. And she tells Tempe that she thinks she knows who's on the audio tape. And it's a young girl named Cora Teague, who's been missing for 3 years. And she tells Tempe, I think you have her remains in your lab unidentified.
And excitement
yes.
ensues from there.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hi, Maggie.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
If there was ever a day that I wanted to push you out of your chair and ask all the questions, this is it.
Well, go for it. Ask a couple.
I have a background in English, my master's, and in environmental ethics and philosophy. And realizing that you have to take the ideas out of the ivory tower, I appreciate that storytellers today, novelists, screenwriters, are the ones who convey in popular culture science and what Bones is doing, for example. I hope that it does, and I hope that you hear that it inspires people to go into the STEM field. Science, technology, engineering, math. I'm curious about the program itself. You have to have screenwriters who are up to speed, who can tell these stories, and I know you're a consultant on it. The whole process of keeping the science accurate and of keeping it part of the story and not making it a soapbox, if it's not part of the story in an integral way, people can dismiss it. How do you keep it in the story?
Well, we have very skilled writers on staff for Bones. I only write one episode per season. We are now about to start our 11th season, which is incredible. We still don't believe it.
It's astonishing for network TV in the 21st century.
We're now the longest running show in scripted drama in, I think The Simpsons have a speed, in Fox history.
Wow.
Yeah. So our writers have become very, very educated in forensic science over the years. Not that we have exactly the same writers that we had in the very first seasons, but they're very good And we also have very good researchers who we will be in the writer's room. When you start to write an episode, you do what's called breaking the story, and everybody's in there together, and that's really fun. You're brainstorming ideas. And we can throw a question to our researchers, and they get back to us within minutes with, you know, exactly the behavioral patterns of leopard slugs or, you know, whatever we happen to be asking about.
Do you have a litmus test for the writers who come on? Would you, if you had to choose, would you choose one with a great background in science or one who's a good storyteller first?
I think there's that's not an area in which I have any control, mm-hmm. but they're hired for their writing skills.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about the process by which, if there's a room full of writers, obviously there's someone who's sort of taking the lead on any particular episode. How are disagreements and discussions worked out? Like, how do you decide when two people have a good idea and they both want to fight for it?
The phrase is, you know, I've got a bump on that. If somebody's thrown something out that they don't think will work or that they don't like, the body's going to fall from the third floor and they're going to find the fracture patterns suggest, you know, it's the third floor, not the second floor. Well, I've got a bump on that. It's very friendly and there's a lot of camaraderie in there and you're there to brainstorm out the idea. When you enter the writer's room to break your story, the walls are covered with these terrifyingly empty erasable boards. And for our show, they're divided into six acts. And by the end of a week or two, you have hammered out your A story and your B story and your C story, if there is one. And you do it collectively. This is very different from writing a novel.
Yeah.
When I'm writing a book, I'm the classic lone writer at my computer all by myself. But in television, you break it collectively, and then you pitch it, and that has to be approved. And then you're sent to write a very detailed outline, and then that has to be approved. And then you write the script, and then they change all kinds of things, which I'm not used to.
Are there things that you feel limited by, maybe supported by in a different way, being on network television as compared with, you know, there are so many subscription model TV services now that aren't affected at all by FCC rules?
Yeah, I think television is limited. Network television versus the cables in many ways because of censorship, because you have to please the studio and the network. Also, we're still doing a traditional 22 episodes every year, whereas a lot of the cable shows are much shorter. Mm-hmm. They'll do 10, 12, maybe 13 episodes. The networks are still pretty much adhering to the traditional start in the fall, end in the spring, whereas the cables really do more of a year-round approach to programming. So there are definitely differences.
Are there ever stories that you think of and you have to ask yourself, is this better told on television or is it better told in a novel?
I do think about that, yeah. Yeah, and there are some ideas I come up with that I think, whoa, I'm keeping that. I may use that in a book or a short story. I've written some digital short stories that are available only for download. There are three Temperance Brennan short stories out there. And there are also, I do a young adult series
right.
with my son. So we've done some short stories. So sometimes I'll think, well, that's a better short story idea or that's a better novel idea or that's a good idea for a screenplay for the show.
And the young adult novels are actually about a relative of Temperance's.
Yeah, it's Tori Brennan, who's Temperance Brennan's 14-year-old great-niece. I have a lot of it's a long story. My son is a lawyer. He practiced a total of 3 years and decided he really hated being a lawyer.
He was a novelist, is what
yes,
he decided.
Yeah, so he said, why don't we, he pitched mm-hmm. the idea, why don't we write a young adult series? And so we pitched the idea. I also would have parents saying, can my daughter read your Temperance Brennan books? You know, and I'd say, well, how old is she? And he'd say, she's 7.
No.
I'd go, no, she can't. So we thought kids would enjoy kids using forensic science at their own middle school, high school level. So we pitched it, and the publisher said, that's great. Now just throw in, you know, some zombies or some vampires. We said, no, we're not going to do that. But we came up with an element of what's called grounded fantasy. So mm-hmm. the kids do have some special abilities. But we explain exactly how this came to be through scientific explanation. And, you know, it's plausible. It makes sense. So the viral series, the main premise is these kids with these special perceptive abilities and their love of science, and they solve cold cases and mysteries. We just released the fifth one in that series called Terminal.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Dave on the line in Dallas. Hey, Dave.
Hi. I had a question about the technological terms that you use on the show. When you have to create a device or something that doesn't really exist and you have to use it for whatever investigation they're doing, how do you come up with the technology and the name and make it sound plausible?
Well, most of what we use actually exists. We may push it to the edge, like the Angelotron. It's a three-dimensional holographic reconstruction apparatus. And we push its limits probably way beyond what one could actually do, but those exist. I've never seen one in a crime lab. They're just too expensive. But, you know, when Hodgins does his experimenting, that's blatantly experimentation, and he's creating things that perhaps don't exist in reality. But otherwise, most of the things that we use, they're out there.
It's been a long time since I was out in the field as a reporter, but I spent some time in police stations and a little bit of time in labs. The lighting on TV shows is always so much better than in any kind of law enforcement facility
yes.
I've ever seen.
Yeah, there's a lot. If you see my actual lab and then you compare that to the lab at the Jeffersonian, it's like there's no question. But if you have an unlimited budget, you too could have the Jeffersonian.
Is there something about stepping into the lab that, like, even the smells that might strike other people of the chemicals as odd are comforting to you, that make you sort of feel like I am here doing my thing?
Well, yeah. There aren't that many smells in the crime lab. If you go to the DNA section or the hair and fiber section or the ballistics section, well, maybe gunfire smells. Where the smells are downstairs in the autopsy room. Mm. And that's a very distinct smell. And no matter what you use, it never really completely goes away. It's a mix of decomposition and disinfectant. So I'm not sure I'd say that's comforting. I'm used to it. There are a lot of people that just before they ever enter the autopsy suite wing say, no, I'm out, just because
yeah.
they smell the hint of it coming. You have to have a certain psychological makeup to do this kind of work.
Did you know at the outset of your career that this would work for you? Was it something you were curious about, but you just decided to explore it and see how far you wanted to go?
Well, I trained to do bioarchaeology, and looking at ancient skeletons that were excavated archaeologically, and I was very happily doing that when police started bringing me cases. So I really hadn't decided to go into forensics. But once I started working on the recently dead, I found the relevance of that very compelling for me, that you could testify in court and if someone was responsible for violence, get them off the streets or help. You're one person in a whole team. Or when you identify a missing family member, you're giving that family an answer. They don't like the answer, but it's better than not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't be wrong. Now, in archaeology, it's fascinating, but if you're wrong, you get into long debates with your colleagues, and you're not going to impact anyone's life. But with the forensics, you do. So I really liked that. I retrained, I became board certified, and I've been doing the forensics ever since.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Ron in Dallas. Hey, Ron.
Hi, Chris. Always a pleasure to listen to your show.
Thank you.
Ms. Rice, I'm sure you're familiar with the writings of Patricia Cornwall, and I was just wondering what you think of her writing as compared to yours. I've read you both and love reading both of you, and how you compare and contrast them. Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
I really thoroughly enjoyed her early books. I think the difference between her character's a pathologist, mine is an anthropologist, but they both work in a medical examiner context. I think the difference is that I actually work in that context as a forensic scientist. She worked in a medical examiner office as a data entry analyst, I think. So she's not a forensic scientist. Her training, I think she has a degree in English. So I think that gives my books a certain authenticity, perhaps, that might make them a little different from hers.
What do you read when you're between writing? Do you always have a couple of novels open on your nightstand? Do you have to stop reading when you're writing?
Oh, no, I read all the time. And I do read a lot of thrillers. I like to keep up with what's going on out there.
Yeah.
I don't want to get 200 pages into a manuscript and figure out that, oh, wait, Harlan Coben just did that, you know. So I like the darker stuff. I like Dennis Lehane, Harlan Coben, Michael Connelly, Joe Nesbo, Karen Slaughter, Ian Rankin, P.D. James. So But I don't just read thrillers. I love British humor. I love like Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Terry Pratchett, Discworld series.
I read a charming story that said that when you decided that you would try to write your first novel, you said, okay, I'll send it out to 50 publishers, and if I get 50 rejections, I'm not going to do this anymore. Is that true?
Yeah. I figured that would be a commentary on my writing, and I would just go back to my day job because I was teaching university full-time and doing forensic consulting. Yeah, that was my – I had a figure in mind, too. I'll take 50 rejects, and then I'll say, okay, they're probably right. And if I sell it, I want to sell it for X amount of money, which is sort of egotistical on my part. But
you did incredibly well on both scores. Were you shocked by that?
Well, I was shocked because the first I did it completely wrong. I just mailed it in mm-hmm. to a major publishing house, and the first house to which I sent it bought it and ended up paying me, you know, way more than I had set my low threshold at. So, yeah, it was shocking. And then it went right on the New York Times bestseller list, and it went to number one on the London Times. And to this day, I cannot explain that, how that.
Do you feel like you learn, at this point, is it 17 Temperance Brennan novels?
This one is number 18.
18, okay. Do you feel like you're still learning, or do you feel like now you have it completely refined and it's just a matter of finding exactly the right story each time to tell your audience?
You have to keep, some things get harder, some things get easier. You know, I know Tempe pretty well, I know Andrew Ryan pretty well, I know Skinny Slidell pretty well. Mm-hmm. But what gets harder with each book is that any one book may be the first book a reader picks up. They've never read you before.
So how much backstory do you give to catch people
up? Yeah, so you've got to give backstory and explain your characters, explain your main premise. But that book may be the 18th book that a returning reader has read. So you have to do it in a new and creative way every single time.
Yeah.
So that gets challenging. You know, I've had her introduce herself through being cross-examined on the stand. I've had her sitting in faculty meetings and she's so bored she begins writing an autobiography. You know, you don't want to just do it through narrative every time. I don't, anyway. Mm-hmm. So
we're speaking this hour with Kathy Rikes. She is a forensic anthropologist and professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She's also a novelist. Her latest book is called Speaking in Bones. She's in town to speak tonight at 7 at the North Richland Hills Public Library. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with screenwriter, novelist, and forensic anthropologist Kathy Rikes. She is the creative mind behind the TV show Bones on the Fox Network, and she's got a series of novels, the latest of which is called Speaking in Bones. She'll speak tonight at 7 at the North Richland Hills Public Library. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Ronnie in Arlington. Hey, Ronnie.
Good afternoon. Ms. Rikes, I'm a huge fan. In fact, I'm watching Bones reruns as I'm folding laundry right now.
Well, thank you.
I have to ask you a question, and I have to tell you why I'm asking it. My partner may very well be listening because I texted him that you were being interviewed, and he may be on his lunch hour. He has his master's degree in cultural anthropology. And when we watch the show, the interaction between Booth and Brennan. Is Brennan, quote-unquote, really that literal? And the reason I ask is because we could be watching the show, we could be talking about the weather, we could be talking about an event, and I can say something, well, geez, that was a million years ago. And the response I get is, well, no, actually, it was about 10 and a half or 11. So is that simply the screenwriter's artistic license, or is that Booth and Brennan?
Well, it's a little bit of both. As you know, the Temperance Brennan on television is different from the Temperance Brennan in my books. She's younger. She's in Washington, D.C. She's, as you say, she's very literal. She's very logical. That's one of the main premises of the show that we thought we'd be able to have a lot of fun with, is that on the one hand, you have Tempe and the squints, as Booth calls them, because they're always squinting through microscopes. They're scientists. They insist on deductive reasoning and logic all the time, never speculate. Whereas on the other hand, you have Seeley Booth, who goes with gut instinct, good old-fashioned cop legwork, intuition. So you have a really different approach to crime solving, and we thought that would lend itself to humor and to possibilities for points of conflict.
When you watch someone else's crime show, does it just make you crazy?
Some do. My kids won't watch with me, some of them, because I'll be, you know, screaming at the television, "You can't do that. That doesn't exist. That you made that up." Or if someone goes to a crime scene and, you know, pumps in pantyhose, I'm like, "What? No." And you'll never see on our show Temperance, she's in her big, you know, blue suit when she goes to a crime scene.
Yeah, it's kind of a refreshing thing. She still looks fabulous.
Well, she does.
But it's not like she's there for a Vogue shoot.
Right, right. And when she goes to her, she'll have her coveralls and then she'll have her hair pulled back. And yeah, so.
Was it strange to you to make peace with the idea that you had this character that you had created that had two different, it's almost like two different universes exist for her?
You know, I would tell people in the early years, think of it as a prequel. Hmm. It's like Tempe, the early years, before what you find in the books, when she's mellowed in the books, she's older in the books. And you have to ignore the backstory, because they've given her a lot of backstory now that she's married and has kids and things like that. But no, and when I sit down to write a book, I like that. I don't have to worry about what TV Tempe is doing on Bones. I can just write the book Tempe and unfettered by that.
So you say you write one TV episode a year. Is that each year's like premiere episode, or does it fall different places in the season?
It usually falls late. We do 22, and I co-write these with my daughter, Carrie Reichs, who's also a lawyer who doesn't practice law and writes novels.
All that money you wasted on law degrees.
Exactly. Why couldn't I figure that out before I spent $200,000 to send them to law school? Typically, the executive producer, the showrunners, will write the season opener and the season closer. And then, so that leaves 20. And then ours, usually because of my scheduling, it works better to break the story in January and then have the script finished and written in April. And then we shoot in April. And then usually we go on somewhere around 19, 20, something like that, towards the end of the season.
Do you think of yourself as a scientist who makes art, an artist who does science? Do you not like the labels either way?
Yeah, it's really a feedback loop. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a scientist, I think it makes me a better writer. I can observe and see details, and I'm on the scene about which I'm writing. I'm in the crime lab, in the autopsy room. So, you know, but as a writer, I think it's also made me more aware of details, of noting details that I might not have. Not the forensic details, not the scientific details, but like, what does a fly sound like when it's buzzing on the fluorescent lights in the autopsy room? Or how would you describe the color of the maggots that are oozing out of a body or something like that? So I think it's really a feedback.
I was thinking about the scientific training and the observation skills that you have to cultivate really almost should be standard learning for anyone who wants to write or to paint or to, you know, do a screenplay. You have to notice things really carefully to decide what you're going to describe.
I think so. And you need to be organized as well. I think going to law school is probably pretty good training for being a writer. It gets you organized so that you can make a logical plot flow. And usually you have more than, in my books and I think in most books and also in the episodes, there's more than one story going on at the same time. You have your main story and your secondary story, your tertiary story, and you've got to be able to intertwine those and bring those all to a conclusion, you know, at the same time at the end of the book. So that takes organizational skills also.
I've been really interested to follow recently, you know, STEM education is still very important and, you know, stressed in a lot of school districts. Now they're adding the A in for arts, you know, and they're calling it STEAM in some places, science, technology, arts and mathematics.
Yeah. I think the impact of STEM, that whole, what is it, science, technology, engineering, math.
Right.
Okay. Is that it is different from the arts. And the arts are where young women were traditionally channeled. So when we decided to do the young adult series, it was because we thought having a strong female like Tori Brennan might make that appealing, get girls to say, yeah, that's cool. I want to be in STEM rather than just the arts. So certainly your education should be well-rounded. You should have both. But I see more need to encourage girls to go into STEM than to go into the arts.
You chose a career in science before girls were really being pushed into this and you know, having people encourage them. What was it about your early background that made you embrace this and take a, you know, the path less taken?
Yeah, who knows? I went to my 10th high school reunion. This was just a couple years ago.
And mine too.
Yeah, they had a little yearbook of what everyone with your high school picture and then what you were doing today. And mine said I had a PhD in, you know, in bioarchaeology, et cetera. And my friend said, oh, yeah, you were always interested in those things back in high school. Well, I didn't remember that, but apparently my interest in prehistory and biology and archaeology went quite deep and early.
Are you a magazine reader?
Not so much. I don't read very many magazines. I'll read them when my daughter leaves, you know, really trash, you know, like Us magazine or Star. I read them in the checkout line.
Right, exactly.
That kind of magazine anyway.
I'm just always interested in the things that people, creative people, fill their brains with. And sometimes there are surprising sources of inspiration. I don't know, you know, people go out in nature or they have sporting hobbies that don't seem to relate, but they say, I do my best thinking on the tennis court, that sort of thing.
Well, I like athletics. I swim laps every day in the summer, and then I work out in the gym in the winter. I play tennis. I tried golf. That just did not work for me.
Really?
Why yeah, not? It just because I sucked. And I'm used to being, I'm coordinated and balanced, mm-hmm. so I'm used to being good at something right out the door.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen. For me, that did not happen with golf. So, and everybody kept saying, you're supposed to be having fun. And I wasn't having fun. I was just focusing on, you know, trying to hit this ball that wouldn't go where I wanted it to go. But yeah, ideas can come from anywhere at any time. You might be in a restaurant and see someone across the way and think, wow, that's a good character, and kind of make a note of it in the back of your mind or even dictate it into the phone.
I'm going to go on a limb here, and I hope you don't think it's rude. I'm guessing you could afford to not be a forensic anthropologist anymore if you didn't want to, but it seems like it's really important to you to continue.
It is. I did the work for so long. I'm not doing nearly as much as I was. I just, you know, between writing an episode and writing a young adult book and writing an adult book every year, that's a pretty, and then touring, it's a pretty tough schedule. I'm still available if they need, for difficult cases, high profile cases. And of course, any case that started that I worked on, no matter how long ago, if it should come to trial, and sometimes there's years before a case might come to trial, I still have to be available for testimony.
Is there tension between people who do what you do and, say, prosecutors or law enforcement officers who really want a conviction? You want to present the science that you found, and it may or may not do a lot to corroborate the case that they're making.
I have never felt tension. I think the cops I work with, you know, I've made it very clear. I think we all make it very clear that we find what we find, and we're going to tell you what we found. Same with a prosecuting attorney or a defense attorney. You know, this is my report. These are my results. Now, the defense attorney can always say, well, thanks very much. Go away. We don't need you, kind of thing. But no, I think they accept that. They know that. And I've never had anyone try to influence my my decision or my conclusions.
When you're working on evidence, you're looking at a cadaver or at a scene. Do you want a lot of backstory, or do you want your mind free of that, and do you want to sort of go into it and just observe what you can observe?
I want minimal backstory. but I don't want anything that's suggestive. I want them to tell me the facts as they know them. And after that, I don't want to know any speculative.
When you're writing, is it always clear to you that the story you're telling will be clear? It seems like the novels have come together so beautifully, and I wonder if that comes easily to you or if it's something that you work on really consciously.
Well, I work on it really consciously, and typically I will be two-thirds of the way through writing a book and think, this is crap. This is terrible. I mean, this is awful. And then somewhere past that point, it all starts to come together.
Mm-hmm.
But I edit a billion times. I edit and re-edit and re-edit and then print it out and edit it again. And yeah, so I'm a crazy self-editor.
Do you think the editing thing is what keeps people who say they want to write but never actually write anything for publication? Is that what stops them? Because, many times if you go with your first draft, you're not going to be happy with what you have.
You're never happy with your first draft. your first draft is junk. You know, it takes a lot of work. It's tedious. Writing is very tedious. I think one of the things that discourages people is if they think, oh, my God, writing a book. That's hundreds of pages. Write a book. Well, you don't have to think that way. Outline your story, get your story down, and then just think about, I'm going to write one page today, one page a day. And at the end of the year, you've got 365 pages. You've got a book. So I think that's a more healthy way to look at it.
Are there days when you can't stop? You're writing page after page after page?
Yeah, and then there are the other days that I don't believe in writer's block. I don't allow myself writer's block. Even if I don't feel like it, I sit there and I write. But there are days when I read it the next morning and go, what were you thinking? You know, because you have the delete key. You know, you can always change it, get rid of it.
Do you keep every iteration of every draft somewhere?
I do not. I do keep a dump file. I call it dump. So mm-hmm. If I go in and I say, wait, that's way too long, and I cut parts of it, I don't just delete it. I put it in the dump file, and I've never gone back and used anything in the dump file. But
that's with that clip folder that you keep. Or...
Exactly, yeah.
There might be something to the act of hanging on to it, though, that allows you to, you know, retain what you might want to use again.
Well, I guess it's like it's your baby. You wrote it. This is brilliant, but it's got to go bonk into the dump file.
Do you have to ever go back into your own books and remember backstory elements or things that come up later?
Yeah, all the time. And I keep all of my books in electronic form on my computer, so if I need to go back and figure out, well, what year was Andrew Ryan born or how old was he, I can just go in and do a keyword search of some kind to try to find that.
Are there words that you realize you use more than other people might use? You know, everybody's got their like little pet phrases or words.
Yeah. Yeah. And I go back and I've used this one 17 times. 12 of those have to go. Mm-hmm. And I'll go back and delete them and change them to something else.
It's funny, though, because some of those are very charming and they're just part of your style and the way you communicate.
Yeah, but the 17th time you've said, I can't think of an example right now. You've said slurp or whatever. You know, it's okay, maybe she sipped instead of slurped or something.
So are you already in your mind working on what comes after Speaking in Bones?
I am. Oh, no, I'm working.
You're actively writing.
Yeah, I'm actively writing. And big newsflash, it's going to be a non-Temperance Brennan book. It's going to be an off-series book. New character, new setting, new premise.
Wow, that's very exciting.
It is, and that's all I'm going to tell you.
All right, well, maybe we'll have you back when it's finished.
Okay.
Forensic anthropologist and novelist Kathy Rikes is professor of anthropology at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Her latest book is called Speaking in Bones. She'll speak tonight at 7 at the North Richland Hills Public Library. Kathy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.